Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
So this morning I want to talk about intimacy and attachment. And I want to start with a quote from Dogen that's in your program. Intimacy is a principle of closeness. It means there is no gap. It embraces Buddhas and ancestors. It embraces you and it embraces me. It embraces our practice. It embraces those of our generation. It embraces our good deeds. It embraces what is most intimate, because intimacy resides all around you. Everything relies on intimacy. Each thing or even half thing relies on intimacy. Oh boy. So, longing for intimacy. Longing for intimacy. We long for intimacy. And that's a longing for interconnectedness, isn't it? That's a longing for interconnectedness. We're already interconnected, but we forgot. So we long for this intimacy with each other that's already here. We do that. And we need to feel intimacy in order to feel interconnectedness, right? There has to be a feeling of intimacy with each other, or with a flower, or with my piece of clothing, in order to feel interconnected with it. So, as human beings, we have a pretty deep desire to feel connected, to live this core teaching that supposedly comes from a guy named Buddha. To live this core teaching. But since we don't know how too well to do that, we crave. We crave. We wish to reach out. But we crave temporary substitutes. A temporary substitute. Chocolate. Sex. Even at my age, believe it or not. Sex. Alcohol. Enlightenment. Oh, that's the one. That's a real deal, isn't it? Continual reassurance from others. Hold my hand to reassure me that I'm doing okay here sitting up on this pedestal 3 feet above you guys. So our longing for intimacy, our longing for this deep connectedness that's here at the base of being, is pretty pure, pretty unadulterated. But then the pain that we feel means that we do these substitutes. We crave these substitutes. And they come out of an agitated disconnectedness. We feel agitated, even though we're interconnected. We want it, but we go about doing it in a way that doesn't help us. Pushing and pulling. Pushing in those people who affirm us, pulling in those people who affirm us, pushing away those people who don't look very friendly, right? Pulling in those experiences, those situations which make us feel safe, and pushing away the other ones. On and on and on. So-called wheel of suffering in Buddhism. The wheel of suffering. But underneath, we all have the same deep longing. You may not be able to define it or articulate it, but it's there. And we feel pain because we don't feel this connection. So we substitute for intimacy all this stuff. And our spiritual longings may include things like, I miss you. I need you. And we think that's a lack of spiritual progress. I don't think so. It's just the heart wanting to open, acknowledging that it wants to go deep and feel this connection. To feel connected with all life, we have to feel connected with each other. We just do. But when we continually act from craving, from clinging, it's not so healthy. And our amygdala, our lizard brain, has taken over. Fight or freeze. Fight or freeze, right? Fight or freeze. And used to be lots of tigers stalking us. Well, still, seems like different people are stalking us. They're saying mean things to us. And so our lizard brain gets all activated. It's all activated. Our old wounds from a long time ago get poked. And we get activated. Our heart races. Our blood flows out to the large muscles to protect us from danger. And we get defensive, reactive. It's a default mechanism. It's not something bad. Not something you're going to outgrow through your practice. You know, if you can outgrow it, I would have outgrown it by now, don't you think? So, a real attack or an imagined attack? This hurts. This is painful. Can we just be with this? Can we just be with it? With an open heart and no judgment? No judgment at all? Just be with it? And then when we notice we want to flee, we want to fight, we want to freeze, that's fine. That's natural. That's natural. Fight. How can you be so selfish, so insensitive, oblivious to my needs? We trigger the other person. The other person says, well, how can you be so insensitive, so oblivious, so totally out of touch with my needs? Right? Right? Fight. Flee. Oh, just withdrawing from the other when they say that. Giving them the cold treatment. We do that. Or freezing. Spiritual non-attachment as a way of masking our craving and longing. So here's a story about spiritual non-attachment as a way of masking our craving and longing. And I think this is probably in a book by Paul Reps called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. But I'm not even sure. There was an old woman who supported a hermit. For 20 years, she always had a girl, 16 or 17 years old, take the hermit his food and wait on him. One day, she told the girl to give the monk a close hug and asked him, what do you feel just now? Most of you know the story. The hermit responded, an old tree on a cold cliff, midwinter, beyond desire. The girl went back and told this to the old woman. The woman said, for 20 years I've been supporting this vulgar good-for-nothing. So saying, she threw the monk out and burned down the hermitage. Woo! Talk about anger. Talk about the amygdala. The lizard brain. So the monk, that's an example of freezing. Freezing as a form of spiritual bypassing, which we do when we get into spirituality, but we do it even when we don't get into spirituality. You just add the spiritual to it when we get into spirituality, that's all. And we become more clever about doing it, more refined. Right? Spiritual bypassing has a more refined way of being. If you don't know that, just practice for a while. Fighting. So, Pamela is taking my picture today. Oh, it's nice. And so I wore my blue shirt for my picture. Somebody complimented me already. But say this person said to me, they didn't say this, but said, oh, today you look good. And then what do I think? Oh, are you suggesting, Paul, that I didn't look good yesterday or the day before that? I thought you were my friend. Okay, let's get outside and duke it out. You know? Right? That's what we do. Or we flee. I just give the person the silent treatment. In spiritual bypassing, the silent treatment works great. because you're above it all, right? You're above it all. But it's not alive. It's not alive. So we have these instinctual habits, we all do as human beings, for self-preservation, but we chronically disconnect from our tenderest parts. From our tenderest parts. And the emotions that we dislike most are those we don't want. We want to bypass them by numbing out or being spiritual or getting high or whatever, whatever. And last time I talked about my early relationship with my wife, when she would get upset with me, I would just go like this. Well, for okay, that may be to give myself a chance to be reflective and open, but to mask my feeling, if I want to develop intimacy with her, I need to share with her sooner or later that this underneath this gosh show, there's some upsetness. There is some feeling of not being okay. And I can mask this with this gosh show for 10 years, but underlying there's no openness to this great intimacy that's always here. It's always here. And in Buddhism we have a very common statement, I'm too attached. I am too attached. But misery comes from a lack of connection and human bonding. And poor early attachment, for those of you who've studied Western psychology, knows that that impairs our development. That there's a wounded trust due to some unreliable connections. And how do you feel when someone reaches out to you? Do you quiver at the sign of being criticized or unwelcome? We had a cat named Soot, a homeless cat. We took him when he was a little kitten with his mother. And he had never had any human bonding. So he hid under in our bathroom on the second floor. We had a washing machine and a dryer, and he hid behind them. Only gradually would he come out. Animals need bonding too. We're animals. We're human animals. Gradually, little by little, he'd come out to get food. Worked on this for a year, 2 years. By the end of 3 years, Soot and I were best buds. Really, best buds. I cried when he died. I still cry. I still miss him. Best buds. So old trauma and abandonment, which we all carry with us, means trust is dangerous. And we do it to a lesser or fuller degree, depending on our circumstances. So the psychologist Susan Johnson says, the only way some children have to maintain relationships with unavailable parents is to minimize their awareness of attachment needs and block out any longing for human contact. But again, we all do this to a degree. So at this Zen center and at other Zen centers around the country, according to my friends, many, many people now are coming who are open about their depression or their anxious depression or their anxiety. And of course, there's a genetic component to that. There can be a situational component, but there are also these childhood wounds from not getting our attachment needs met. We want to close or run, but if we can feel the pain non-judgmentally and then reach out, we feel better. Soot learned this. It took him 2 years to learn it. And he wouldn't have learned it in 2 years had I not gone up to the second floor, and Linda too, by the washing machine 3 or 4 times a day and sat there with him. Well, it takes that much TLC to open our hearts to each other. But if we open our hearts to each other, we feel this wonderful support by all life. We see that that's our natural way of being. That's our natural way of being. So Rumi says, what is intimacy except in giving and receiving? What is intimacy except in giving and receiving? Forming and maintaining heart connections, heart attachments. So what is this deal about letting go of attachment in Buddhism? Well, it's letting go of attachment to beliefs, to self-image, to being in control, and to words that disconnect. But not to heart connection, not to making heart connections, and not to feeling some grief and sadness when a heart connection is missing. That's part of being human. That's part of being human. So beliefs. Let go of attachments to belief. Some of you just finished the Nagarjuna class. How many of you just finished that class? Anybody in here? One, two, three. Well, so you just went through Nagarjuna's negation of all beliefs in Buddhist and non-Buddhist India at the time. That's what he did. He negated each of them because he saw that people were attached to them. Role, position, or self-image. That monk with the 16 or 17-year-old girl, he was attached to being not attached, wasn't he? And the old lady could smell that. She could smell that. You can smell that. You can smell it. So, as most of you know, I've been practicing for a long time, and in the 60s and the 70s, there were lots of people running around with the Tao Te Ching in their back pocket. The Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, The Way and Its Power, which Wanda will be leading a study group on in the fall. It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book. But everybody was running around with it in his pocket. And many people were using it as a form of spiritual bypassing. Oh, I'm just going with the flow. You know, yeah, I slept with her, but now I'm sleeping with him, and now I'm going to sleep with her. It's just part of the flow. You know, they didn't take responsibility for things. They didn't follow through. The future would take care of itself. Fake Taoism. But, you know, we do that. We do that. We get attached to being non-attached. Control. Attachment to control. Trying to change others or to get them to conform. Been trying to get people to lead the meditation, walking meditation outside. Oh, is it possible? Can I get them to do that? Probably not. Maybe I should just practice what I preach. It's possible for me to practice what I preach, but kind of hard. Much easier to preach it, right? Much easier to preach it. So beliefs, self-image, being in control, and using disconnecting words. So I feel threatened. My lizard brain feels threatened. It lights up with anger. You spend too much time with your friends, Linda. You never have time for me. Old hurts around rejection. Coming from the ancient past. I could get in therapy and work on this, but it'll probably take another 50 years, and I'm already 74. So. You know, there you go. It's just the lie. It's just what life's like, you guys. Instead of connecting, instead of when you're with your friends, I feel lonely, Linda. That's simple. Opening up my heart, expressing my loneliness. Simple. Sipping the Zen Master, whatever that might be. My goodness. But these practices, these attachments that we do, emanate from our longing for connectedness. We all have a longing for connectedness. And there's a deep love and sense of intimacy that percolates below that longing. It's percolating, always percolating, waiting for us just to calm down a little bit and open up to it. Open up to it. So can we stay with the ache of bodily desire and tell the person what we really want? Maybe we yearn for closeness, want sex with our partner, and then bark, "What's the matter with you?" But we're longing for deeper intimacy, aren't we? Aren't we? And can we tell them that? Can we just tell them that? It's possible. It's possible. Our cravings get split off from our deep longing. Our feelings that are in our tissues, if we can be with those, if we can open up our hearts to them, there's freedom in just that. With no hint of judgment, no hint of criticism. So, as good spiritual practitioners, or good zazen doers, or whatever we're aspiring to be, we want to eradicate craving, but we can't transcend the lizard brain. Read about it, you guys. It's right here in your brainstem. You can't get rid of your brainstem. You can't. It's right here, and it serves a purpose. It serves some purpose. From an evolutionary perspective, and it continues to serve a purpose. It still puts you on alert. Sometimes you need to be on alert. But you can't transcend it by avoiding relationships, by avoiding our feelings, by avoiding wants, by avoiding longings in the surface of whatever. But right now we're talking about spiritual practice. We're picking on spiritual practice, but it can be any kind of practice. The desire to eliminate desire. Good luck. Good luck. So my first teacher, Suzuki, my friend was working on her thesis, her master's thesis, and she was really avoidant about doing it, really avoidant. And so she, when it was time for her to work on her thesis, she'd sign up to do a retreat. She hated retreats, but it was time to work on her thesis, then she signed up to do retreats. So she told me that Suzuki said to her in Dokusan once during a retreat that first day, "Why aren't you over there working on your thesis? Why aren't you over there working on your thesis?" So we're sensitive as we try to get our heart connections met. But we're all sensitive as we try to get our needs and our connections met. The person doesn't call us back, and we want to push away. Just like that adult who didn't respond to us when we were a child. And there's no perfect parenting. Everybody's like this because our parents try their best. I tried my best, but there are still some wounds from childhood. There's still some lacking of attachment that we carry with us. And then we get into spiritual practice, and that's good. Spiritual practice helps us in this. That's what I'm saying. I'm just talking about the things to beware of. That's all. So beware of. Saying too often to yourself, "Let it go, don't cling, don't be attached." Because then you feel more pain and more shame, or you dull everything out. If possible, gently hold these feelings, these unwieldy feelings, these awkward feelings, these yucky feelings. Just hold them with your big heart. You may think your heart's tiny, but if you just hold them, your heart is as big as the universe. If it can hold your own pain, it can hold someone else's own pain. It just does on its own. So that means welcoming, or at least accepting, not welcoming without dissing, accepting our craving for sex, admiration, alcohol, whatever. Welcoming it into our bare awareness of our zazen. And your anger. What about your anger that's still there after all these years? Can you see it as a pained protest that reflects your longing for connection? Can you see it that way? Regardless of how petty it is, how hard it is, that it's a pained protest masking, reflecting your longing for connection? And lo and behold, a deep sense of connectedness spontaneously arises as we see the feeling, as we allow it to be with us and move deeper without chattering, chattering messes it all up. But then you say, chattering's bad, I don't want to chatter. Well, and then you chatter about not chattering. Well, I do this too. That's just a human situation. You can laugh a little bit a lot about that, can't you? So Dogen says, because intimacy resides all around you, everything relies on intimacy. Whatever it is, intimacy with the sadness, with the anger, with the drinking a cup of water, whatever it is. So our practice then is less about letting go of ourself and more about loosening our clinging so we can deeply connect with others and with what is. Resting right here with whatever comes up right here. With the waves on Lake Calhoun that I'm trying to remember the name of, De Makaskar. I said that over and over in my head. I wish they could have come up with a little more easy to remember Lakota name. Anyway, the waves on the lake. Sometimes the surf sucks. Sometimes there's no surf. We only want to be by the lake when it's calm. But the lake is the lake. Without the waves, it wouldn't have its life. It wouldn't have its contours. Without the clouds, there'd be no sky. We see one cloud in the sky, and we really appreciate the sky, the clearness around it. If there's no cloud, we might just ignore it because of that cloud. And maybe a little rainstorm that comes down on us. We'd really appreciate the sky. At least I do. So maybe all interpersonal clinging is an attempt to get the nurturing that we lack so that we can feel this intimacy. Maybe. I used to be, for a brief period of my life, a couples therapist. And one thing that I learned in the couples therapy that I was doing was that when a couple comes in for therapy, most couples have unconsciously looked for and found a mate similar to the parent that they had attachment issues with as a child. Now, we can get into this. I could spend a whole talk on this. And you can choose to believe it or disbelieve it. But the theory is that unconsciously we have this need. So we look to a mate who's similar to the parent we didn't get this need met with to be our mate. And then we have a huge difficulty, which is a huge opportunity. A huge opportunity. Because can we then in this new relationship have a give and take and a natural development of attachment that we didn't in the childhood? And of course the answer is yes. Yes. Yes, but it takes some, patience and some persistence, right? Just some patience and some persistence. So in intimacy, if we hold our pain, or our friend helps us hold it, our anguish and our anxiety ease. There's less isolation, and there's a freedom, a real freedom. So in my early years of sitting, of doing Zen practice, I thought spiritual longing for the connectedness with all life was great, but tended to diss my longing for personal connectedness. It was like I wanted to move beyond that. But what is big connectedness doesn't include people? It took me about 40 years to learn that. Well, I don't want to discourage you. Let's say it took me 4 years to learn that. No, I don't want to discourage you. Let's say it took me 4 months to learn that. little by little. Become more transparent with the people that we really want to develop heart connection with. And then we can be more transparent with life, with the universe. Responding from our longings rather than reacting. Instead of, you never want to have sex, I need to hold you and feel close to you, and sex helps me do that. Cancer survivors with a support group live years longer. People with pets or networks of friends live years longer. People who take in homeless cats who live under their under their washing machines for 2 years live years longer. Somebody, when I was giving a similar talk to this recently, someone asked me, well, what about monastics? What about hermits? And I gave an answer, but I thought of a better answer today. my better answer is that in Zen, we don't do hermits. But you can do hermits, so that's not part of Zen. We'll do a retreat for 7 days. We'll go to a practice period for a couple of months. Or even as my two Japanese teachers did, go to a monastery for a couple of years. But then we go back out in the world, because this is about connectedness in the world. And even in those monasteries for a couple of years, Katagiri and Suzuki both used to talk about how body language, movement, nonverbal use of eyes, how that's all part of the heart connection. It takes place at a deeper level in the words. So the failure to bond fully underlies a whole bunch of our craving and longing. And it's never too late to develop supported friendships and bonds. So here at Zen Center, we do practice periods twice a year, and we have one coming up in the fall, in the beginning of October. And everybody has a partner, and then they're asked to meet once a week with their partner, at least, just one-to-one. Oh. And I think people should get to choose their own partners, because you shouldn't feel like this is sort of some big arduous project for you. This is just learning to be more human. And then we have mentors here. Now we have 55 mentees for the different teachers. And that's cool. That's cool. Another way of establishing heart connection, of establishing attachment. And then thirdly, you can meet with me. You can meet with me. Well, I better not say every day. You meet with me a whole bunch, or irregularly. Or you can do all three. Why not do all three? Why be so self-depriving about reaching out, feeling connected to each other? In the service of what? Of what? So next time you're feeling deeply frustrated about something or someone, just hold it. Just open up your heart a little bit and see if there's a yearning for closeness underneath. A yearning for intimacy. A yearning for feeling part of something huge that includes all life that's right here. Right here. So I want to end with this. I think it's Rumi. I'm not sure. Could be some other Sufi. I think it's Rumi. The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They're in each other all along. The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They're in each other all along. So the other day I was having a one-to-one with someone, and she walked in my office and she said, "Well, last time I came in here, which was maybe a week or two before," she said, "I just paused at your door, and I saw you sitting behind your table," and she said, "I felt a great stillness emanating from you." And I said, "Oh." I said, "But you felt the great stillness. Who was it emanating from if you felt it? Who was it emanating from? It's emanating. It's emanating, right? I don't have it. It's emanating." So I said that to her. She sounded surprised. Ooh. But I think she believed me. So lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They're in each other all along. All along. So that's what I want to say this morning, and I'll be glad to take questions or comments from the high seat. Yeah, Chris.
So, you talked about not being able to transcend the lizard brain.
Yep.
And there are some studies that have shown the amygdala gets smaller in long-time meditators. It doesn't disappear, but...
That's right. That's right. So there's some hope. There's some hope. It gets smaller. And that means that my amygdala should be smaller than yours. Oh boy, let's compete to see who can get the smallest amygdala, right?
But it only takes a couple of months to shrink it, right?
Yeah. It only takes one sitting. Because I don't want to discourage you. Anyway, it really is. It's only one sitting, and then one sitting, and then one sitting, and then one sitting. That's all it is. Other people. Other people. Yeah, hi. Welcome home.
Of course, what you said about lovers don't find each other, they've been within each other all along. It sounds very poetic, but it's confusing because so many people are in love or truly love someone and don't feel that that there's the same feeling on part of the other person.
That's right. That's right.
Is that aspiration that we should remember that hopefully love works that way, and mostly it does?
I do think that is an aspiration, to realize that. That is an aspiration. And to do it and not do spiritual bypassing means that we have to feel the jealousy, we have to feel the discouragement, we have to feel the angst on the way to opening up to this fact that Rumi is just saying what Dogen said in a different way. Dogen said, we're intimate with this, we're intimate with that, everything's intimate with each other already. So Rumi's saying the same thing, and that can be an aspiration for us to open up to that, and that is what Zen practice is about. But we can't bypass it by bypassing our confusion, our jealousy, our sense, and even our hopelessness. Sometimes we feel like that's hopeless. That's a hopeless idea. Well, then I feel that hopelessness. Then I'm with it. And usually if I feel hopeless, it actually relates to something that happened to me a long time ago. But I don't need to go to the psychotherapy about that. I just need to be with it. And as it begins to open and soften up, I begin to feel it. You are in me all along, even though I don't know you. Even though we just had a fight, you've been in me. And then it goes away, and but it's always here. It's base level reality. How's that? Well, and of course you can believe in it. You can have it as a belief, but attachment to belief doesn't help much. So we need the practice of just feeling what is, feeling without labeling. Pardon?
So I wonder then if intimacy might be the same thing as being present for other people, if that's pretty close.
I think being present and intimacy are pretty close. Pretty close. Being present. So intimacy could be being present to the fact that you have a really strange belief. And if I'm present to you have a really strange belief, and I have another really strange belief, or I wouldn't think your belief was strange. Can I be open to that? Can I be intimate with that? And if I can, then there's a bond between us that just naturally develops, which comes organically out of the sitting process. Does not come from consciousness. So consciousness has to help us. You know, I've been talking lately about shoulds. We need some shoulds, but only enough shoulds that support our authenticity. Only enough shoulds. We get entangled with shoulds, and our practice is about those shoulds that help us support feeling connected with our deepest selves and even our shallow selves. Because if we don't feel connected with our shallow selves, we can't feel connected with our deepest self. Come on.
So can you, I think I'm with you. So can you also talk about how impermanence plays in with this?
Yes, well, impermanence, of course, is part of this whole thing, because I finally think, oh, I realize that my heart's undivided from yours. Then you don't pay attention to me during coffee, and I think to myself, oh, she's forgetting that we have this heart connection. But everything is changing. And heart's undivided intimacy means that everything's changing, always. So this so-called intimacy that we pin down isn't real intimacy. Real intimacy is when we let go of pinning it down, and we notice we're trying to pin it down and just feel the anguish and let it go. Not when we say to myself, I'm letting it go, but just let it be. Let it be instead of letting it go. We let it be, and then we feel intimate with it. But yes, I can't depend on anything. We can't depend on anything. Even though I wore my blue shirt today so that you could take my photo.
I don't know
how that turned out. Yeah, Tanya.
I actually started thinking about intimacy more in our culture and society during your talk. And one of the things that I really struggle with personally is that I work in a corporate business environment where sometimes it seems like the culture is intentionally against individuals becoming intimate with each other.
Mm.
And most recently, really occurred to me because we have a tendency to value personal privacy to the extent where we don't share each other's deepest going on.
Yes.
And I had heard that one of my coworkers that I was very pretty close with may be suffering from a very serious illness And I just had the sense that if I didn't confront it straightforward and just, okay, I am completely going against social custom, but I'm going to just directly ask you what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had another coworker who was out from work for a year and a half, and I never found out why he was out from work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just something that I struggle with, is kind of balancing.
So you did that. You reached out to her.
I reached out to my coworker.
And what was it like? What did it?
And it took a little coaxing, because initially he was like, oh, somebody's betrayed my trust. How do you even know to ask me that? But then I kind of worked with it, and then he really opened up with me.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, yeah, I'm dealing with cancer for the third time. Ah.
So you were glad you did it.
I was really, really glad.
And you did feel more connected to him and to yourself.
Yep. Uh-huh. But I felt like it all had to be done kind of in private, in secrecy, because...
Yeah.
It's not okay within the office environment to share that you're struggling with.
Yes. Well, did you guys hear what she said? I can't disagree with her. Capitalism has some wonderful strengths, but it also has some deficits. And if the money-making urge is not combined with some kind of core value of whatever the core value is related to producing something wonderful that people enjoy, or being candid with each other in relationships, if there aren't those core values, then the capitalism is very insidious. But it doesn't have to be like that way. It depends on. Actually, it depends on the core values of the leaders too. I used to lead a nonprofit, and everything happened. What can I say? And my nonprofit was a for-profit nonprofit, because big nonprofits are really always trying to make money to stay alive, right? So what can I say except that try to work in organizations where you get a feeling that they have a core value that's more than making money, that it has to be making money, but that there are other core values there, and check out the people who are in charge. Check out the people who are in charge. That's about all I can say. And I'm not saying that I did it perfectly, but that was always my core value, to manifest just what I've been talking about today.
I think I personally have found over the years that I have to put aside my desire to be socially acceptable with the larger group, and sometimes I have to prioritize making that connection.
Well, good for you. Good for you, and it hasn't boomeranged on you.
Not yet.
So good. Well, good for you. And we also have to choose. We have to choose. We shouldn't put the amygdala to sleep. I mean, the amygdala senses when we're in a threatening situation. And, to self-disclose when a boss is coming around who, doesn't share my orientation to the world, the amygdala should pay attention to that. And I wouldn't say fight the boss, but you can freeze or run away or do both. We need this amygdala. Yeah.
I'd like to do an and.
Okay.
Like you just described, because I was hearing the part about capitalism leads to something negative, or the leaders lead to something negative. There's another possibility, and that is that if there's been a history of people abusing vulnerability, having a rule that puts some limits on it prevents people from being hurt.
Yeah.
And one could argue, maybe that's out of balance. It could be more balanced than it is.
Mm.
But when there's power differential and you have power over me and you could use something I shared under an assumption of confidentiality against me, then suddenly that's a concern that goes beyond the individual or goes beyond...
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Time for one or two more, or we can just move on. Oh, sure.
How would you... My name's Kevin, I'm visiting.
How would I what?
My name's Kevin, I'm visiting. I had a question about how would you distinguish connection and intimacy from attachment?
Well, I'm using them... in regard to people, I'm using them as synonyms. Heart connection is attachment. I form a heart connection to you, and then I miss you when you're not here. And that's healthy attachment. That's healthy attachment.
So connection and intimacy are the source of suffering?
There is suffering in that. But it's a deep, kind of clear, clean suffering, which just is open and doesn't get involved in all kinds of criticism and commentary. It's just, just the pain of being human. It's a wonderful pain, actually. Oh, I miss you. I miss you. It opens me up to the pain of the birds outside and the pain of the plants that are trying to climb up the screen there. And their own pain. So we're not promising rose gardens in Buddhism, in Zen. But just the pain of being alive is a clear pain. It's a calm pain. It's a wonderful, all inclusive pain. Do you believe me? You don't need to believe me, but feel your way along. If you believe me, that belief may help you or may not help you. But feel your way into this practice. Is there someone else? Oh, Bonnie?
Go ahead.
Francie?
Do you want to say something about when positive attachment turns to negative attachment?
Well, when positive attachment turns to negative attachment, it's not attachment in the as intimacy anymore. It's not attachment as connectedness. Negative attachment means I'm getting attached to my belief or to my self-image or to my needing to be controlling. That's what it means. And that kind of attachment really has to be seen, opened up to, experience and let go of to experience this deeper attachment. Does that make sense? You knew the answer to that.
I thought I would.
Francie.
Oh, I asked a question that has to do with
Pernia's
pointing to the Four Noble Truths. And the, for me, the truth of suffering, that there is suffering. And then the practice of being with that suffering, with an open heart, and that, for me, learning that is just part of the human condition. What we were talking about a moment ago, and the practice on the cushion is about building a capacity to be with that. Intimacy develops with oneself, and then that transfers to the capacity to be intimate with others. I think that's
right. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, thank you for summarizing. Boy, I've got all these friends who I have heart connections with. Wow, what a deal. Thank you. Thank you, Francie. Okay, well, time's up, so I think I'm going to turn it over to Jim. You know, I am so intimate with Jim that I've forgotten his name. That's a sign of real advancement.
Blessings.